through 18. The visit of the Magi is kind of a transitional theme, at least in Christian liturgics, because it beckons to our next season after Christmas, and that is Epiphany, where we are called to follow a star. Nevertheless, it seems appropriate to talk about not only the Magi, but what transpires after their visit to Jesus. Because then we see that there is a dark side even to Jesus' birth. The Magi were most likely Babylonian astrologers, and we know that in the time of Jesus, in the Seleucid dynasty, that the idea of astrology had advanced and astronomy was getting going, and these individuals were probably very wealthy and also very educated, and they were following what Scripture calls a star, but probably what it was a planetary conjunction. And my sense was, following scholar Michael Molnar, that it was a conjunction between Jupiter and Saturn that took place in 6 BC, which the whole Mediterranean world could see. And my sense is that's what they followed. I know Jesus was born in 1 AD, but the fellow who did change the Julian calendar to the Christian calendar got it. He was seasick on a boat, and I think he got it wrong. So I believe that Jesus was born in 6 BC in part because Herod the Great, who will play a part in our text this morning, died in 4 BC. So Herod was around at Jesus' birth, unfortunately. So the Magi travel a long distance from the east to get to where that planetary conjunction kind of holds fast, I suppose. And they find out from Herod the Great where the Messiah is to be born, in Bethlehem, which is about 5 miles southwest of Jerusalem. And there they find the baby and they give him gifts, gold, which I think is appropriate if they thought that Jesus was going to college, maybe, and frankincense. And frankincense is interesting because it was often used in the temple as part of the fragrance that was given when an animal was sacrificed. And myrrh, too, is a resinous substance, and some scholars suggest that myrrh is what bodies were wrapped in when they died, which may or may well be the case that Matthew was averring to that, but it also could be a costly smelling incense that, again, would add to the coffers of this poor peasant family. What we know about Herod is not simply that, as we shall see, he will slaughter the infants in Bethlehem in order to try to rid himself of this Messiah of whom he is terrified, but we know from extra-biblical sources that Herod was just a bad guy. I mean, he could have led ISIS easily, or Al-Qaeda. I mean, he would have risen to the top rather easily. We know that Herod had some of his wives killed. He even had some of his sons killed. And the little grim joke was that it was better to be, because Herod was part Jew, he was Idumean and Jew, that Herod kind of kept the Jewish customs and he wouldn't eat pork. So it was the idea was that it was better to be Herod's pig than Herod's son. And there's a play in words here that, since I have a little time, I don't have a children's sermon. The Greek word for pig is U-I-I-S, wis. The Greek word for son is U-I-O-S, weos. So there's just one letter of difference, right? So the joke around town was, it's better to be Herod's pig because he wouldn't eat you, but if you were Herod's son, he'd kill you. In 4 BC, he probably dies of stomach cancer or some intestinal ailment. And he was so mean that he said, because I want tears in Israel when I die, he rounded up in a hippodrome near Jerusalem some of the Jewish intelligentsia at the time, so that at the moment he died, all of these people would be put to death. That's the kind of guy we're dealing with here. But fortunately, saner heads prevailed, and those people who were going to die, the guards and Herod's soldiers, quote, mutinied, and they went free. So we're dealing with a very, very evil man, and he does an evil act. And indeed, we need to incorporate that into the birth story as well. With that bloviating and extended introduction, hear the good news of the gospel. After Jesus was born in Bethlehem in Judea during the time of King Herod, Magi from the east came to Jerusalem and asked Herod, "Where is the one who has been born King of the Jews? We saw his star in the east and have come to worship him." When King Herod heard this, he was disturbed, and all Jerusalem with him. When he had called together all the people's chief priests and the teachers of the law, he asked them where the Christ was to be born. "In Bethlehem in Judea," they replied, "for this is what the prophet has written, 'But you, Bethlehem, in the land of Judah, are by no means least among the rulers of Judah, for out of you will come a ruler who will be the shepherd of my people Israel.'" Then Herod called the Magi secretly and found out from them the exact time the star had appeared. He sent them to Bethlehem and said, "Go and make a careful search for the child. As soon as you find him, report to me so that I too may go and worship him." After they had heard the king, they went on their way, and the star they had seen in the east went ahead of them until it stopped over the place where the child was. When they saw the star, they were overjoyed. On coming to the house, they saw the child with his mother Mary, and they bowed down and worshipped him. They opened their treasures and presented him with gifts of gold and of incense, frankincense, and myrrh. And having been warned in a dream not to go back to Herod, they returned to their country by another route. When they had gone, an angel of the Lord appeared to Joseph in a dream. "Get up," the angel said. "Take the child and his mother and escape to Egypt. Stay there until I tell you, for Herod is going to search for the child to kill him." So Joseph got up and took the child and his mother during the night and left for Egypt, where he stayed until the death of Herod. And so was fulfilled what the Lord had said through the prophet, "Out of Egypt I have called my son." When Herod realized that he had been outwitted by the Magi, he was furious. And he gave orders to kill all the boys in Bethlehem and its vicinity who were 2 years old and under, in accordance with the time he had learned from the Magi. Then what was said through the prophet Jeremiah was fulfilled. A voice is heard in Ramah, weeping in great mourning, Rachel weeping for her children and refusing to be comforted because they are no more. This is the word of the Lord. Sometimes I think in looking at this text, I'm taking a shotgun where a fly swatter could be used. Because the title of my sermon is, "Must Everyone Like Us?" And indeed, Herod did not like Jesus at all. In fact, Herod killed, in order to try to extirpate this child of promise. There was a gentleman who reached his 100th birthday, and so a reporter went to the small town where he lived and said, "You must be very proud of this accomplishment." And he said, "Oh, yes, I am." And he said, "I want to tell you something. I don't have an enemy in the world." And the reporter said, "Well, that's wonderful. What a life you must have lived." And he said, "Oh, yes, my last enemy died about a year ago." Death, taxes, enemies, people who don't like us. When ministers get together, we're fond of telling of that we've all had this experience that the people who welcome us first to a church and who think we're the new Messiah are often the ones who are most disillusioned and are the ones who want to stamp your ticket to Nowheresville or getting out of Townsville, whatever happened. I was talking to a friend who is a minister who recently retired, and I said, "Do you miss it?" He said, "I do, but I've often thought that I was much too sensitive all these years to be a minister because you accrue certain people who don't like you, and ministry would be better served perhaps by CEOs who didn't care whether people liked you or not." I'm not sure whether that's the case, but I am sure that we do imitate Jesus by gathering enemies. And it begins with Herod, and it ends on the cross, and throughout Jesus' life, people dislike him. I mean, Herod never knew Jesus, never knew anything about the child. How could he? But I find that as we go through life, we will find people who don't like us, and we have no understanding why. Because we're pretty nice people. When I look out at you, we're all pretty nice people, and we understand how people can get so angry and disillusioned with us. What's going on here? When I worked in Manhattan at the Addiction Institute, I worked with people in a group setting, in a group modality, so I'd have 8 to 10 people who would talk about their lives and the problems they were having with drug and alcohol. And there was this one woman in her early 30s who was new to my group. I had not done her intake, so she just walked in and sat down, and everyone greeted her. She took one look at me, she stood up, and she left, and out of the hall I could hear her say, "I hate him. I just hate him." And I was hoping she was talking about the custodian or something, but I knew who she was talking about. She was talking about me. She just sat down in that chair, looked at my face, and said, "I hate him." And I thought, my goodness, I don't think I'll ever understand that. But I was fortunate enough to have another therapist who had worked with her, and she told me that I resembled her father. I looked like her father. So that's why she hated me. Transference was immediate, I'm afraid. But for most of us, there are some people we meet in our lives that we'll never understand why they dislike us. You know, the best we can get from them, maybe, "I just don't like your face." You know, when I look at myself in the mirror, I can say, "I understand that. I appreciate that." But we don't understand that. But Jesus, we can kind of understand when he becomes an adult and he begins to do the work of God and he begins to preach in a way which alienates some people. So throughout his ministry, and it begins in Nazareth in Galilee, when there are groups of the religious aristocracy who come from Jerusalem up to that area just to follow him around because they want to trap him, they want to debate him, they want to humiliate him, and they want to destroy his credibility in any way that they can, and they fail on all accounts. And what's so ironic too, and maybe we can relate to this, is that when Jesus does his best work, they really hate him. And so in John 11, Jesus raises Lazarus from the dead in Bethany, which is near Jerusalem. It's in many ways, if not his greatest miracle, it is well wrought. It takes a whole chapter. Then Jesus dramatically says, "Lazarus, come out of the tomb." And Lazarus, still in his grave clothes, comes out and is standing there. And they all have dinner together after that. But there are people who are watching this from a distance, and they report back to Jerusalem. And then in John 11:53, the religious aristocracy gets together, and they say, "So from that day on," the day that Lazarus was raised from the dead, "from that day on, they plan to put Jesus to death." No good deed goes unpunished. Do you have that experience? You do the right things and you get slammed for it. At least when we do the wrong things and we're criticized or maligned or whatever, we can understand it. But when we do all the right things and we're still criticized, we're saying, "Lord, what's going on? That's not fair." First Peter says that Jesus committed no sin, no guile was found on his lips. When he was reviled, he did not revile in return. When he suffered, he did not threaten, but he trusted in God who judges justly. So the issue that I think we face is, do we need to be liked by everybody in order to feel good about ourselves? Do we need to be liked by the world, by everyone we meet, in order to feel good about ourselves? And what is it about having maybe 99% of the people we know like us, and that 1% that doesn't like us, and who takes over in our thoughts and our minds? That 1%, right? That one person who gets under our skin, and suddenly we feel our lives are not as they should be because of that. The need to be liked by everybody stifles spiritual growth. Let me say that again. The need to be liked by everybody stifles spiritual growth. You know, Jesus said, "Beware when everyone speaks well of you." Beware when everyone speaks well of you, because then probably you have nothing, you have no edges, you have nothing to say that might indeed be controversial. And you know, we're in the political season now. And what we see with our politicians, or what are they doing? They're trying to appease everybody. They're trying to appeal to everybody. They'll say one thing to some group and say the very opposite thing to another group. And perhaps why some people like Donald Trump is that he seems so politically incorrect, doesn't he? He is an equal opportunity offender. He'll offend this one, he'll offend that one, and you know, there is something pleasing to people about that, because he's not trying to be liked by everybody. It seems in some way that he doesn't care. Beware, Jesus says, when all people speak well of you. And I guess we want to ask ourselves, is it okay to have an enemy? Because in having an enemy, that means we have a take on life which causes them to be alienated from us. We have an opinion. We are who we are. The gospel of Popeye is, I am's who I am. And that is important. Several years ago, I was dealing with a couple, and they had a little girl, and he had come from a very religious background and she had not. And nevertheless, they thought they could work things out, but he said, I'm bringing my daughter to church. And we had talked about that before we were married, and she said, look, I'm not going to church, certainly, and you're not bringing our daughter to church, and don't think you're going to have our daughter baptized as well. And he said, well, we had talked about this before our marriage, and we're going to have it done whether you like it or not. And he said to her, he said, my grandmother told me to stick to my principles and horse trade on my particulars. And this is a principle. Our daughter is going to be raised in the church whether you like it or not. And she said, well, I hate you for imposing this on our daughter. And he said, that's fine. I'm glad you hate me. That makes me even stronger in my faith. And that's going to happen. And of course, wonderful things happen from that because of his stand, because of his principled take on life. She not only went to her daughter's baptism, but she started going to church, and she indeed became a Christian. Of course, that didn't sit well with her parents, and suddenly she was on the outs with her atheist family, but it was okay. When we take a position which involves integrity and strength and morality, even if people don't like it, it doesn't matter, because God is on our side and God will redeem us and take care of us. And we will be a witness to those who have no belief or who have no sense of strong morality or integrity whatsoever. We need, in some way, to make enemies. I'd also like to say, too, it's important to have enemies because they help us grow in the spiritual walk, because what they say about us may have a kernel of truth. Let me say that again. What our enemies say about us, and it may be couched in malicious talk, it may be couched in gossip, it may be couched in slander, but there may be a kernel of truth to what they say, which we need to hear in order to grow. And often, you know, we throw the baby out with the bathwater and say, this person is against me, which that person is against me. Person doesn't like me, that's true. But is there something that I can use to help me grow in my faith? And often I find there is. When I went to seminary, I had a friend who was very, very politically active. He was down marching in Washington all the time. He was involved in every political issue. And he had theological justification for that because the great theologian of the 20th century, Karl Barth, said, when you preach, make sure you preach with a newspaper in one hand and a Bible in the other hand. And he took that seriously, so seriously, however, that somehow the Bible got shortchanged in the light of contemporary and current events. And so a fellow before he left the church said to him, Pastor, I just don't like you at all. And one of the reasons I don't like you is that I don't hear enough of the Bible from you. And you know, I can get the newspaper every day of the week. I can turn on the television and get bad news every day of the week. But I need to hear biblical good news from the pastor that I'm sitting under. And you're not giving it. With that, the parishioner left. And my friend the pastor was hurt, he was angry, he wanted to strike back, but then he thought about the criticism. And although it was couched in a way that could have been said, I think, in a more polite manner, nevertheless, he thought about it and he said, Lord, if there's anything in here of truth that I can use, let me use it. And of course there was. And suddenly he found the balance so that Scripture became more important in his preaching. And not only did his congregation grow, but he grew. And at the end of about a year, he wrote his former parishioner a thank you note. Can you imagine that? He wrote his former parishioner a thank you note. Can you imagine that? Winston Churchill was one of the great statesmen of the 20th century, certainly. And one day he received a letter from an Englishman, and he was accused of being a liar and a murderer. And it was said not once in this letter, but it was said three or four times, Mr. Churchill, you're nothing but a liar and a murderer. And Winston Churchill wrote him back, and he said in that letter, let me get it, he said, where am I? I'm sorry, I think I'm still tired from Christmas Eve, so can we cut the tape for a minute, and I will find it. Ah, I found it. Forgive me for that lapse, that spiritual lacunae. Churchill writes this, the fact that you do me the greatest injustice does not deprive you of my sympathy, since you obviously have suffered much. And I think Churchill was saying, you know, I can take good criticism and take it to myself, but when the criticism is unjustified, when I'm called a murderer and the liar, that means that there's not something wrong with me, but there's something wrong with you. And I think that's where I want to leave it, because often being good people as we are, whenever someone criticizes us, whenever we accrue a new enemy or two, whenever someone says something about us, we take it to heart and say, it must be my fault. I must have caused the rift. Instead of having the discernment of Christ and saying, you know, I may be just fine, But it's that other person who's having problems. It's that other person who's just anger, and I am just the target of his or her anger. It's that other person who has mental problems, not me. I may have mental problems, but not as serious as this person who's detracting and who is my great detractor. I mean, I think the good news of the gospel is that we can learn, we can take kernels of truth from our enemies, and that's helpful. Our enemies teach us also, you know, when there is no kernel of truth, to be patient and kind and merciful, just as Mr. Churchill was. But in the end, I think we need to say, you know, we are of Christ. Christ loves us. Christ died for us. Christ is with us. And maybe we're better than we think we are. And the problem is not ours. The problem is another person. And our response to that person should be mercy and kindness and compassion and love. And if we do that, we have fulfilled the gospel in every great way. Thanks be to God for our victories. Please stand and greet one another this morning.